How are we doing today, Kyle?
Good morning. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Fantastic. So you enlisted in July of 1984. Can you kind of give us a rundown of what brought you to joining in the military and then leading up to your career?
The way you say 1984 makes it sound like a long time ago.
96 yeah, baby talking.
Yeah, I joined in 1984. It was a time for me in my life when I just had no direction. I was out of high school, but I hadn't gone to college. I didn't have any money. There was just so many. I always tell people I was like at the bottom. You know, there was no place to go but up, kind of thing. And I knew several. I had relatives and several friends that were in the National Guard, and they always seemed to have money in their pocket for, you know, for a beer run or for cigarettes at the time. Shame on us. You know, but they always seemed to have money for gas and all those things. And I was literally broke. You know, okay. If I pulled my wallet out of my pocket and opened it up, moths would fly out.
Wow.
You know, I was literally at the bottom, one of the lowest points of my life. And I just decided I have to do something. I don't know what it's going to be, but I have to do something. And again, watching these other folks who had money in their pocket and had friends, I didn't even hardly have any friends at that time. And I just saw them kind of living life, and I was just struggling. And I thought, I have to do something. So I went and talked to the recruiter. Some folks took me in, and we had a discussion. I did have a job at the time. Mm-hmm. And I remember after I talked to the recruiter, I went and talked to my employer, and I said, hey, I'm considering joining the National Guard. What do you think? Is that going to be a problem? And at the time, she said, absolutely not. You know, if that's a wonderful thing, if you want to join the Guard, go ahead. Well, you know, it was a security job, so we were working around the clock. And she said, we'll work out the schedule with your drill weekends and everything else. So long story short, I went in the next day with the recruiter. I signed the bottom line, as you know, and raised my right hand and joined the Guard July of 1984. And the following day, I went back to work, and I just so happened to run into my boss in the parking lot, and she said, you know, have you thought more about joining the Guard? And I said, well, funny you should ask, because I saw the recruiter today and I signed up, and yes, I'm a member of the National Guard. And she said, come in my office, I want to talk to you. And I went into her office, and she said, you are a very poor employee. I'm terminating your employment right now. Hand me your badge.
No way.
And I was absolutely shocked and stunned. And maybe at the time I was a bad employee. I don't really know. You know, as an 18-year-old kid, I probably was. But I was absolutely shocked, and I literally handed her my badge. She walked me to my locker. I cleaned it out and left the building with no job. So, again, absolute, you know, lowest point of my life. And so, anyway, joined the Guard and spent 2 years as a drilling guardsman, a traditional, you know, 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks a year. And then in July of 1986, applied for my first full-time job as a unit clerk, a AGR position. I got it, mm-hmm. and my career just continued from there. So I spent that AGR job was out at the aviation here in Bismarck, and I spent a total of 11 years out at aviation. I switched from AGR to technician, and went from being a unit clerk to a flight operations type person. But
sure.
Spent 11 years in aviation, and then I I loved it out there. I absolutely love aviation, still do. I loved that job, but I realized after 11 years that I was just going nowhere.
Yeah.
I kind of hit a glass ceiling, and I knew that if I wanted to move forward in the organization, I was going to have to take a sidestep. So I left aviation. I went to the state maintenance office in the G4 shop, and I spent 3 years there. I was a fish out of water, really, I was not a mechanic. I had no maintenance background whatsoever. What I was good at was organizing and doing paperwork. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I spent 3 years there organizing and doing paperwork. And then decided I liked computers, and kept watching back then it was the Duum, or the, you know, what is now the G6 or the CIO shop, and applied for a couple jobs there. Finally, in the year 2000, I started working full-time in the in the computer realm, and I've been there ever since. So 24 and a half years.
Dang.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I mean, your story of when you were young, 18-year-old, you know, and hey, questioning joining the military, no money, like you're doing the right things. I'm sorry, but like I hate your whoever employer was. I hope they're. I mean, yeah. You can look back at that now and be like, ha, I made it. You know, I think that's crazy. That's yeah. a crazy story. Wow, that's nuts.
Yeah, it's funny because I, you know, at the time, the guys that I knew or the friends I knew in the Guard said, you need to go see a JAG because yeah. she can't do that. And, you know, I'm just an M-Day brand new guy. I hadn't even been to basic training. And I'm like, what's a JAG?
Right.
I don't know what that means, you know. So it was funny, though, many years later when I was in aviation, I did have the opportunity to tell that story to a JAG officer, and he said, oh, man, we would have raked her across the coals. You know?
Seriously.
We would have taken her down. You know, at the time it was too late, didn't it? You know, the seven-year window had elapsed or whatever.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
I didn't.
Yeah.
I did certainly didn't want to pursue that. And, you know, I just left it behind me.
Sure.
But it is kind of a funny story that I got fired for joining the National Guard.
That's insane. And then you came back full time and like just went. That's awesome. So you've talked to me quite a few times. And for anyone listening online, Mr. Skager is the CIO for the J6 department. And he's been my manager my supervisor slash boss for the last 2 years of me having a photographer position. So me and him have had many conversations, and I'm just super happy that we can sit down and have one on record. But to kind of caveat my thought here with your career, you went to aviation, and you've told me some crazy stories at aviation. Now, whether they are, you know, there are certain things, but can you talk about some of the fun things that you did while at aviation starting out your career?
Oh my gosh, there's so many. You know, I went, when I first joined the Guard, I joined the MP company when they were in Mandan still. We had an armor in Mandan. And it was a very, and I think much like now, a very strict company.
Sure.
You know, they were, Saturday morning, you know, it was an hour and a half formation to check everybody's shiny boots and haircuts. And, you know, it was very, very strict. And I enjoyed that,
mm-hmm.
The unit, I guess, you know. But I went from that to aviation, who our formations at that time were sitting in the lunchroom with our coffee cups. There were, you know, to say the word formation, they would look at you strangely and go, what are you talking about? You know, and I think things have obviously changed there too, but this is back in 1986. So, but just, you know, what a great, great group of people that was. You know, they were very, very professional. You know, when you got around the aircraft and in the mm-hmm. cockpit, they were absolute, the consummate professionals in life. But outside the cockpit, and you know, when it was time to work, they worked hard. When it was time to play, they played hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is back in the day when we went to AT, and, you know, we could have beer in the field. And, you know, at 5 o'clock.
Yeah, different Army then, you know.
Yeah, you started cracking the beers open, and you know, it was a work day. It wasn't field duty. It was a work day, even though we were sleeping in tents or whatever. But just so much fun. And, you know, again, what a great, great group of people. So trying to think of, you know, some funny stories or something. One that always comes to mind is as the flight operations person, mm-hmm. I used to give a lot of tours of the helicopters to, you know, any school groups, Cub Scout groups, sometimes mm-hmm. groups of adults, you know,
sure.
just any group that wanted a tour, wanted to see the helicopters up close. We would give them a little briefing and then take them around the helicopters and out in the hangar. And I remember one particular young group of kids, about 4 or 5 years old. And, you know, again, we gave them the briefing and we walked them around the building, talked about what the pilots have to do to get ready for a flight and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And some of their safety gear. And then we take them out in the hangar, and you open the door to the hangar, and it's this huge, huge building.
Mm-hmm.
And the floor is painted white, and you've got, you know, 6 or 8 or 10 helicopters sitting there. And, you know, for a little 4 or 5 year old kid, their mouths just fall
on the floor. Yeah.
Wow, this is amazing. And this one particular group, we brought them out in the hangar. And I remember a little boy, he just kept looking at the floor and he had this really quizzical look on his face. And before we started climbing around in the helicopter, he raised his hand and I, you know, called on him and said, "Do you have a question?" And he looked at me and he said, "Why is there a drain in the floor?" You know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, it really struck me that, you know, I think the helicopters are the coolest thing you're going to see, right. You know, drain. All day, all week, all month, maybe for your life. And he wanted to know why there was a drain in the floor. So
that's
just,
awesome.
Yeah, just a lot of fun. So.
Well, and that's great. You know, a lot of, I mean, aviation is, I mean, and including the MP company, right? Very, a lot of units will, you know, change different commanders, blah, 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 blah. Like the MP company today, like today, and I'm sure back then, like you said, were just super on the ball because their job is, you know, to maintain a discipline mm-hmm. type because they are the enforcers of laws, et cetera, and right. military law. So so that makes, like, that's just cool that I didn't realize you were in an MP company beforehand. Shows how much I know. Yeah. And then going to aviation, yeah, you're doing flight ops, stuff like that. And then, yeah, getting, I mean, aviation, even today, they still get kind of thrown around as the, check out our cool things, you
yeah,
know.
Absolutely.
You know what yeah. I mean? And all the MPs are like, well, now we have, you know, MRAPs and, you know, these monster vehicles
right.
that are taller than, you know, most. And, well, I don't know how tall a Huey was with its prop
right.
back. But, you know, anyway. So you went to aviation. You decided that hey, I needed to progressively grow. In what way? So you went the chief, or you went. Did you go warrant, right? And
yeah.
then,
so my time in aviation, of course, that's where we have a majority of warrant officers, or
yeah.
at least half of our North Dakota warrant officers are pilots or in aviation. And my time working out there, again, great group of people, and I remember several instances where warrant officers would look at me, and I was a E5, E6. I made it to E6 before I took on the warrant officer challenge. But many times they said to me, "You should be a warrant officer."
Yeah.
You know, and they put that little seed in my ear, and it for years I kept thinking, yeah, that'd be awesome. But mm-hmm. I knew I couldn't be a pilot because I was colorblind. And so I knew I would never, nor did I ever want to fly. As much as I love aviation and as much as I love to go riding in those helicopters, I have no desires to grab the controls. Never did. But they kept saying, "You should be a warrant officer. You should be a warrant officer." And so, again, they just planted that seed. Well, when I left, I knew I wouldn't be a warrant officer in aviation. So when
right.
I left, I started looking for opportunities. Could that happen? You know,
right.
could I be a warrant officer? And lo and behold, I'm talking to the warrant officer recruiter and talking to some personnel folks.
Mm-hmm.
A position was available in my MOS, which was administration. And, boy, that was not a hard decision for me
yeah.
to say I'm at least going to try it
yeah.
and see what it's all about. So yes, I left the enlisted field, went to warrant officer school. That was April of 1999.
Okay.
And made it through that school and all my tech schools and everything. And
yeah.
one of the very, very best decisions I ever made in my life was to be a warrant officer. And I will always say I didn't do it because I wanted to sleep in the BOQs. I didn't do it because I wanted to be saluted. I did it because I knew I was going to be part of this organization for the long haul.
Oh, okay.
And I thought, I want to do the best I can for the organization and for myself and my family.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I tell a lot of people I probably doubled or even tripled my retirement just by going to warrant officer school
yeah.
and becoming a warrant officer, you know, my military retirement. And it also took me further, I think, on the technician side.
Yeah.
Than I maybe would have made it as enlisted, you know, I can't repeat history, so
right.
or go back and try it again. But for me, it was one of the best moves I ever made.
That's awesome. Well, and I mean, you talk about like tripling retirements and stuff like that. Like warrant officer is not, you know, your stereotypical, okay, you enlist and then you go up through the chain. Like warrant officer is a specific specialty. So it's
right.
It's a lot of, you know, hey, you're the guy. Like you're the SME. If like SME is used a lot, especially
sure.
with, you know, when you're in a big battalion where, okay, you got medics, you got mechanics, who's the SME of this machine, right?
Right.
And usually it falls onto like an E6, whatever. But the step up is, like, if you really want to be the SME, you're the warrant officer. Right. They're the one to go for any questions, any asks. Like, so that's pretty challenging. Like, I don't know what the requirements of WBUC were at the time, warrant officer basic course. But, like, even today, we just had somebody come back from warrant officer school and was like, yeah, that wasn't, you know, easy. So, for progression and stuff like that, if you're in for the long haul, why not make the best of what you can, you know?
And that's what my thought process was. And I knew, talking to other warrant officers, that, warrant officer school, not the easiest school to go through. You know, it's not jungle warfare school.
Yeah.
But certainly, they put the old proverbial, 10 pounds of crap in a 2-pound bag, and you got to figure it out. And what you learn very quickly is they do that on purpose, obviously. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they purposely overload you. They purposely give you too much to do. And it forces you to take a step back and prioritize and say, okay, what's important here? Mm-hmm. What do I have to get done? And what can go by the wayside? And it's, mm-hmm. They'll tell you it's all important. But you learn very quickly that as long as I am good on my physical fitness and pass my PT, and as long as I pass academically, so I have to study. So, yes, my bed may not be as perfect as it could be. My sheets might be a little messed up, but I got a 99% on that exam.
Right.
And you can't throw me out as long as I'm passing PT, passing academically, and I don't have any honors violations.
Yeah.
You can't get rid of me because my bed is messed up.
Right.
And you'll learn that very quickly. So that's the point, is to help you prioritize. And for a warrant officer, when you're done with that and you come back to the unit, it's very much the same thing.
Yeah.
There's 100 things to do. What's the important?
Right.
What is priority one, priority two? That's what you have to take care of.
Yeah. And that's such a, that lesson is such a big thing outside of the uniform. You know what I mean?
Right.
Out of the service. As a younger soldier in the guard, oh my gosh, how do you prioritize, when you're getting into this career and you're making those big decisions, et cetera, what's the most important thing to me, right? Is it going to school? Is it going for a warrant? Or is it, I'm happy where I'm at right now. I'm going to just sit and kind of grow, And then I'm going to go to school, but because I've got family, I've got a dog, I just bought a house, prioritizing is such a crazy thing.
Yeah.
It's a beast. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And for the military to directly, but also indirectly, make you learn the prioritize thing is super cool.
Yeah. When I got done with warrant officer school, I had a wife and one child at the time, and you are a different person.
Yeah.
And it's because of that kind of mentality that you're talking about. I grew up, definitely grew up at basic training as well.
Yeah.
When I came back from basic training, my dad picked me up at the airport and remarked, you're not the same kid that left. And I wasn't.
Yeah.
And the same thing at warrant officer school. I wasn't the exact same person when I came home.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I will say in that vein is I remember being at warrant officer school and before I left thinking, what am I going to come back? Who am I going to be when I come back?
Right.
What am I going to be? And I remember in about the third week of the four-week warrant officer candidate school, we had to go in and talk to the TAC officers.
Yeah.
It was the only time, first time and only time at the course we'd had a one-on-one with a TAC officer. So I went into her office, and she was a tough TAC, and she was very feared by the whole class. And I remember standing at her desk, and she asked if I had any questions, and I said yes. I said, I've been waiting. And she almost came out of her desk because I knew she was thinking I was going to say, I've been waiting for this course to get hard. I've been waiting for the challenge. And that was totally not where I was going. But she started to literally come out of her chair. And I said, I've been waiting because I'm supposed to be somebody else by now.
Mm.
And I'm not. I'm still me. What's wrong?
Mm.
And, of course, she sat back in her chair and she relaxed a little bit. And then she counseled me and said, And what became clear to me is you are who you are, regardless of what school you go to, what rank you hold, where you are in life. You are who you are. However, you just might be a little better version of where you are. And that's what I really found out. And it took me years after warrant officer school, years as a warrant officer, to realize, I'm just going to be who I am, but just a better version of who I am. So did that carry over into my personal life? 100%.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it made me a better dad. Yeah. Maybe it made me a better employee, those kind of things. So from that perspective, that was really a growing 4 weeks
for me. Well, and I love that you say that, you know, like I said, or just kind of in the back while you were talking, like sharpening a sword, you know what I mean? Like we're all this tiny thing, you know, like kind of dull at first, and then all we're doing is honing the blade through our entire career.
That's a great analogy. It's only been a few times in my warrant officer career that I always say I had to pull my warrant officer out.
Yeah, you know? Seriously.
Only a few times, but they were effective when I needed it.
Yeah, well, and that's a crazy thing you say that, you know, especially for newer leaders in the Guard, right? Okay, you just got your stripes, or you decided to go the OCS route, and now you're in the unit. Like, how do you effectively use the power of your rank? And it's a balance, you know what I mean? The most effective warrior is not is the most brutal, you know what I mean?
Right.
It's the one that can be tactful and strike when needed to be strict, you know, like, et cetera.
Yes.
So as somebody who's kind of in this new leadership role and taking on more learning to when to prioritize, you know, using the power and when to not use the power is such a huge thing. And it's almost wise. Like you said, I don't know who I should be. You know, you question that as a leader. It's like, okay, when do I need to be the NCO, or when do I need to be this? Now, we all know you're the NCO and you're Sam, or you're Kyle and you're the chief warrant officer, right? Like, when do you effectively need? And yeah, so it's a really cool story and how, like, she got up on her chair and was like, oh, I'm about to use warrant officer. And then she sat down, you know, it's that grace and, you know, give and take. So with that being said, when you became a warrant officer, you were also a technician on the Duma. Is that what you said?
Duum.
Yeah. Duum. That's
Director of Information Management.
That's awesome. So. It just reminds me of the old Duum games.
Yeah, we call it the Temple of Duum.
Well, I'm glad that joke was resonating then.
Yeah.
So on the tech side, you were dealing with a lot of computers, and even in the administration side, right, and under being a chief, how much of that, I mean, from back then to now, what have been some of the craziest things that you've seen, you know, from how we do things? I mean, I'm sure you've been around when, like, the floppy, I saw a 201 file for the first time when I did admin, and I saw a floppy disk, and I was like, you're kidding me, you know, granted, hey, I grew up on VHS tapes and cassette players, but I had never used a floppy disk.
So when I was hired in the CIO shop or the SIX shop, I was the 14th full-time person.
Oh wow!
Hired, and we are now 34 strong.
Yeah,
you know, so we've grown that much. It has changed just drastically. So as an example, when I first started, I started at the help desk like so many do in the SIX shop. And we were loading towers, not laptops. We didn't have any laptops. We were loading towers one at a time by disk, by 3.5 inch disk. In my brain, want to say it was 11 disks, you know, and we would put in one disk at a time, and it would take half a day just to load the operating system and Microsoft Word or whatever we had at the time. So it was a very slow process. Anybody that needed help either had to bring their computer to the SIX shop or we had to go to them. There was, during that time, I knew everybody that worked in Bismarck.
Oh,
and
wow.
Most of the people at camp in Fargo and all the outlying areas, I'd been to every armory. I knew every full-time person. And then we went from that to, we got Dameware, which is a remote product where we can control your computer remotely. And that, to me, was a huge dynamic shift in the SIX shop, where our help desk people stopped having to travel to fix your computer. Here, let me jump online and fix this for you.
Right.
Which is way faster, way better technology. However, we lost that one-to-one personality.
Service, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Customer service, in my mind, just took a huge nosedive. Mm-hmm. Not that we weren't helping people.
Right.
But to help someone looking them in the eye or standing at their computer saying, here, let me drive and let me fix this for you, versus here, let me jump online and
steal your ship, you know.
Yeah. Don't worry what I'm doing. Don't look. Just go have a cup of coffee and come back and it'll be fixed, you know. We lost that face-to-face interaction with our customers. And to me, that was a big, massive shift in technology and in our customer service. And again, not that we don't provide customer service. It's just different.
Yeah, yeah.
Not less, different. And now, today, what we're facing in the near future, and it'll be obviously beyond my time here, we are migrating off our own network.
Right.
We are migrating onto Big Army's network, and that interaction we even have with our customers today is going to change again.
Right.
And it I don't know that it's a change for the better. Again, right. In some aspects, every technology is a change for the better and a change for the worse.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what this is going to be. I see a very clear day coming very soon where we no longer have telephones on our desk. You will just answer your computer when somebody calls you using Microsoft Teams probably that
sure.
most people are aware of now. You know, back in the day when I started, I worked 2 years on the help desk, and then I went to the visual information department, which at that time managed all the video teleconferencing or VTCs. Mm-hmm. And we went, you know, then it was remote meetings, and I spent, you know, oh my gosh, days, hours, weeks, months, years, just managing video teleconferencing for the state and had all these meetings. There was the 1 year I remember in particular, I worked 24 weekends that year.
Wow.
Just managing video teleconferencing. Oh, and throw on top of that all the mobilizations for the global war on terror.
Yeah.
So we were video conferencing with soldiers and families, you know, families were video teleconferencing with their soldiers across the seas, which was amazing because they could see their soldier who was deployed in Iraq or, you know, wherever overseas. They could actually see their face and talk to them face to face, if you will, over video. That was a new technology for us, and it was absolutely amazing. But it just added, you know, so much work and whatever, which is great. Although that was the busiest time of my career, it was also my favorite time because I was positively affecting change. I was positively affecting people's lives.
Right.
Because, you know, I can't tell you how many people would walk in that room, see their soldier over in Iraq, and,
just
turn into a puddle of tears.
Yeah.
Well, I affected that.
I
allowed that to happen. And I make it sound like it was all me. You know, it was a team effort, but I was the one there that was running the show. So. Right. I got to see all that, you know. I got to watch the generals, the adjutant generals, or the chiefs of staff, or battalion commanders address their troops overseas. You know, that just wasn't a thing before that time. So what
you
a wonderful
everybody,
technology.
You know, if you wanted to talk to anyone.
Well, now, you know, with Teams and the technology we have now and moving onto the Army network, that's just going to be an everyday thing for us.
Right.
I've been told that National Guard Bureau in Washington, they've gotten rid of most of the phones on their desk.
Wow.
If you call a number, you probably won't get anybody to pick up. But if you jump on Teams and ring them,
right there,
they're right there.
Wow.
They'll pick up immediately. That's the world we're headed to.
Yeah.
Again, there's some downsides, but there's some wonderful things about that too.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny how you had to load everything onto a CD at first, right? So like back when Adobe 2004 was on a disc.
Oh my. Yeah.
And you uploaded it. Like you said, we're getting better, but we're also losing some things. And I think we're now at this point of realizing it, you know. So like you're saying, well, I could see the phones being gone for a while. How do we bring back the human communication of it? Like when you were traveling all over the place and you had that one-on-one conversation. Well, video call is a thing, and it's more accessible now than it has ever been. And you look at streamers online, everyone's doing streams, and it's just becoming a norm. So how can we bring back that human touch element without having to also, you know, lose the fact that you don't ever see me or know who I am? I'm just a person taking control of your computer or whatever. So that's interesting how it's going back into that. That's just crazy. It's crazy to me.
And the answer for me is there's no easy answer to that except you have to make it happen.
Right.
You know, you have to get out of your desk. And I say this, you know, to so many people, leadership by walking around is a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get out of your desk. You have to go visit somebody's office. It's an effort now mm-hmm. to have that face-to-face, one-on-one communication.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to do that, in my opinion.
Yeah.
There's recent studies now that say I just read this yesterday. A recent study said a two-minute face-to-face conversation with a person, not over video,
mm-hmm.
is more effective for longevity in life than a 15-minute phone call.
Yeah.
And they were specifically talking about someone perhaps in a nursing home.
Sure.
That even if somebody, whether it's a friend, a family, a employee of the organization, stops by for 2 minutes mm-hmm. and says hello face-to-face is more effective and makes them feel better, raises cortisol levels, all dopamine, all those things.
Yeah.
Than a 15-minute phone call would. So that face-to-face stuff is so important, and again, we've lost some of that organization-wide and worldwide.
Right.
You know, look at the anonymity of social media mm-hmm. and where I think that has taken the world politically and
sure.
obviously socially now. We have lost a lot because you can say anything you want online.
Oh, yeah, no one touching
for it. And things that you would not say to somebody's face.
Right. When you're with somebody, you learn to say things better in a sense. So let's say we're having a hard conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't do what I needed to do.
Right.
Sam, hey, your podcast sucks. Let's talk about it.
It doesn't, by the way.
I appreciate that. But, you know, having that conversation, you learn to address and attack things in a different way compared to, like you said, on the phone or on a computer. There's no way for anybody to quote unquote retaliate in a, you know, there's not as much barrier, you know what I mean? So you are coming to them at face value, literally and physically.
Yeah.
So that's interesting you bring that up. So with that being said, when you became a chief warrant officer, you became the chief warrant officer 5 for the state. What was that like, and how did that come to fruition?
So how it came to fruition was I was an admin warrant officer.
Yep.
Working in IT, so I was never MOS qualified. I never went to my tech courses as an IT person. I always stayed as an admin warrant officer, so I was not MOS qualified. Well, for good or for bad, what happened was in order for you to be promoted
mm-hmm.
in anything, you have to be qualified for the position. So what they did, what the state did me a favor for my first couple of promotions was they would move me to a position where I was qualified, mm-hmm. promote me, and then moved me back. Great for me. I didn't have to go to schools. I didn't have to do anything. And then I was ready for CW4. And I went to the command chief, Chief Junt at the time, and I said, hey, Dave, I'm ready for my promotion. Time for you to move me so I can get promoted and move me back. And he had one of those hard conversations, and he said, Kyle, we're not going to move you this time.
Wow.
You either go to school or you sit as a W3. We're not going to move you, or you find a position you are qualified for. And of course, I was not happy about that, but went back to, you know, my office and brooded about it a little while and then thought, you know, I'm not happy, but they're doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Chief Junt retired and Chief Sizer, Shelley Sizer, took over. And I went back to her and had the same conversation. Hey, Shelley, I'm ready for W4. Time to move me and promote me. And she, I think, had been briefed that I was coming, and she sat me down. She said, I'm not going to do that. However, here's an opportunity you can take or not. It's up to you. We have a position for you, CW4, in your admin field, but I'm not going to move you there, promote you, and then move you out. If you take this position, you're staying there. Wow. So I had some tough choices to make. So I thought about it for about 3 seconds,
mm-hmm.
and I said, I'm in.
Yeah.
I'll take that admin position. I'm all in. I understand what the consequences are, but I'm ready to be promoted. And I was ready for a change on drill weekends, too. I needed something different. So long story short, I took it, and I became basically the assistant to the command chief warrant officer, the CCWO assistant. And I sat in that position as long as Chief Sizer was there, and she was there 3, 4, or 5 years, whatever it was. and got promoted to W4 and became her assistant. Well, by becoming her assistant, I learned everything that the CCWO does, you know, what the responsibilities were, how it was done. I learned everything behind the scenes. So when she retired, they opened it for applications. Me and another CW4 applied. I ended up getting the position.
Nice.
How did that feel? To this day, maybe it's a little different today, but at the time, imposter syndrome. You know, because because here I'm an admin warrant who's been in IT for, you know, 15 years, not even doing my job. I couldn't, if I had to be an admin warrant and go to a unit and teach them something, I wouldn't know what to teach because I didn't know it. If you wanted me to teach them computers, I could do that. Admin, I couldn't. So I was a fish out of water. And then I was, now I'm in a leadership position. I mean, as a, you know, as senior NCO, as a warrant or as an officer, you're always in a leadership position. Mm-hmm. People are always watching every move and everything you do and everything you say. But now I'm at the top of the triangle, right? Wow, am I supposed to be here? Am I doing things right? And there's always that imposter syndrome. What got me through all that, and maybe I was a good CCWO, maybe I wasn't. People are going to have differing opinions. But I always went back to my roots of treat people the right way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not going to be able to fix everything. I had to have some hard conversations with warrant officers and say, I'm sorry, but you are not going any further in this organization. Well, that's a very difficult thing to tell anybody that you're done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're basically done with you. Thanks for your service. We don't need you anymore.
Yeah.
That's a hard thing to tell anybody. But I just went back to my roots of let's do the right thing. Let's treat people the way that we would want to be treated.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest will fall in line. And that's kind of always been my leadership philosophy, if you will, is, and I've said this to you before, Sam, if you are in a leadership position and you take care of your people, mm-hmm. the people will take care of the mission.
100%.
They'll get the job done. If they know, and people can sniff out falseness or BS, if you will. They'll sniff out if you're not being genuine. But if you genuinely take care of your people, let them know you're all in, you got their back, you get the resources they need as best you can. You mm-hmm. can't fix everything. But if you take care of that and do those right things, mm-hmm. they'll get the mission done.
Yeah.
You don't have to stand over them and micromanage. They know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
If you give them the resources and the direction, they'll get it done. But you have to take care of them because if... And I've had supervisors who provided everything
mm-hmm.
except that intimate one-on-one, I give a dang about you.
Yeah.
And I don't work as hard for those people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because I don't know how to do it or I don't want to do it. It's just that they haven't provided me the impetus
right.
to do it by doing this, you know, mm-hmm. you're going to affect this and this and this. You need that one-on-one, face-to-face leadership time with people.
Right.
Now, as a CCWO at the top of the heap, I had 100 warrant officers underneath me, so to speak, at least I was trying to lead. I didn't command any of them, even though it's a command warrant position. But trying to do the right thing, trying to show them a path for their next step, And just genuinely, again, trying to show that I cared, mm-hmm. that they're here, and that they're important. And I've always said, too, you have to know where you fit in a strategic plan.
Mm-hmm.
Because we all fit in, you know, the mm-hmm. state strategic plan somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that you do somehow adds to our plan or the North Dakota National Guard's plan. But if you don't understand where you're at and why it's important that you're doing what you're doing, it's very hard to be motivated.
You kind of get lost. You're what am I doing? It's like you're talking with this impression thing, right? Compared to, I mean, how long were you the CIO?
The CCWO?
The CCWO. Sorry.
Just a little over 3 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
So while you're as the CCWO for 3 years, where were you at in your career? Like, how were you close to retirement out of the military? Was that like your final thing? Or
well, when I took the position, I knew, and it doesn't have to be this way, that should probably be your final resting place, if you will,
yeah.
as far as your career. It's the pinnacle position. You know, you've reached the very top. There's nowhere else to go.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I could have stayed there longer, but I made a promise to myself that I knew that there was a lot of people behind me,
mm-hmm.
But only one person can be in that position at a time. So I knew I wanted to be there. I wanted to do the best job I can, and then I wanted to get the heck out of the way and let somebody else have the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So when I took the position, knowing that that was the beginning of the end of my career, I was okay with it. And so I did. I spent the 3 years there, I think just a hair over 3 years, and then got out of the way and let somebody else have that opportunity. It was probably one of the best 3 years of my life there,
yeah.
too, as far as my M-Day side or my drilling side. And not because I knew I made the top.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's always wonderful. You know, if you're the general, you know, in charge of the organization, there's only one.
Yeah.
same here with the warrant officers. There's 100 warrant officers, and I got to be that one on top. But I also didn't let that cloud the fact that there's still work to do.
Right.
There were still warrant officers to take care of. There were still conversations to have. And there's so much good. You know, you get to promote people. You get to award people. You get to do all these wonderful things, too. But I just didn't forget the fact that just take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, have conversations so they know where they stand, for good or for bad.
Right.
But just always take care of them. I've made a habit over the last few years, probably more so the last 3 years, of when I see in an email or online or something where somebody got promoted or somebody's retiring or, you know, there's a positive change in life, I handwrite a congratulations card to a lot of people. And every single one of those that I write, I end that card with, "We are a better North Dakota National Guard because of you."
Mm-hmm.
And I don't write that, you know, to be trite or anything. I truly, honestly mean that every individual that's in the North Dakota National Guard or in the military period, we're a better organization because
yeah.
of what you have done. You wouldn't be moving up the chain, you know, with promotions. You wouldn't have made it to retirement if you didn't do something. And if that's simply doing your job, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
We need those people that just come to do their job. But you did something to add to the organization, and we're better for it. So I truly, truly mean that. And as the command chief, I try to always have that in my mind, that every one of those 100 warrant officers has a job and has a place and has a purpose in the organization. So as the command chief, it was my job to make sure that they have the resources and the guidance they need
mm-hmm.
to continue to do that job. Again, was there some missteps? Was I successful? You know, that's debatable.
Everybody
has an opinion, and that's wonderful. But I did the best that I can do, and that's all I think you can ask of any person, any soldier, any airman, any employee. Just do the best that you can do, and that's all we can ask of you.
I love that. I love that. Can you talk about the visual information section and it's kind of its upbringing?
Sure. When I was at the help desk, and then a position came up, it was called visual information manager. And I didn't even myself know what that was. There was somebody in that position, he was a major, and he knew nothing about photo and video, if you will.
Okay.
They used that position at that time strictly as the VTC, or video teleconferencing person,
okay.
and distance learning classrooms. They combined those two things. So at the time, that's all that person did, was manage 6 distance learning classrooms and a few VTC machines. We had very few at that time. And that's all they did. But I knew when he left that position and they advertised it, that there was some photo and video in there. And I loved photography. I'll maybe talk about that a little bit, but how I got started in photography. But I knew that was part of this visual information thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, I'm going to apply because, A, it's a promotion, technician-wise.
Yeah.
And, B, I will put up with the video teleconferencing, which I didn't love, in order to get to the photo and video stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I started. I applied for the job. I do remember I had a terrible job interview. Sometimes when you interview with people that you know, it's harder. And and I had worked in this in the G6 shop. I'd worked for these guys for a couple years, and I knew them very well. And then I went into a job interview with them, and you know their first question was, "Tell us about yourself." And I went,
"Don't you know everything?"
Yeah. And I completely froze. Anyway, walked out of that job interview going, well, I didn't get that job. And then lo and behold, by my surprise, they offered me the position and I took it. So started that. And yes, we had already received some cameras, some digital cameras from National Guard Bureau. I think they were at the public affairs office at the time because they're the only ones who knew how to use cameras on the full-time side. And so I got in that position, got familiar with all the video teleconferencing and the distance learning and did all that. And then started working with the public affairs shop a little bit on, you know, the photography part of it and what they were doing. And all that evolved to, you know, a very long story. I could go into a lot of detail, but it evolved into, hey, we're not doing DA photos here. And that's a regulatory requirement.
Right.
And I thought, hmm, here's an opportunity to grow the camera section a little bit. You know? And it was under my job description and not public affairs. So anyway, and at about that time, the six shop was growing, and we were outgrowing the basement of where we are now here at Frame Barracks, and we had to start moving into another building. And we came into the building where we're recording this right now, which is, this is an old vehicle maintenance shop. We had a, right where you and I are sitting was a PX at one time.
Heck yeah.
It had been so many things. But anyway, they I moved over into this building, and they decided to remodel the building. And I had requested a photo studio so we could start doing these regulatory DA photos. And lo and behold, I got it.
Love it.
To my shock, I thought, there's no way they're going to go for this. But I asked for a photo studio. I got it. And I didn't even know how to run it. I didn't know anything about studio lighting, how to set up a camera for a studio. I didn't know any of it. I just knew that, hey, we got a photo studio. So anyway, so that's kind of how it started. Again, there's a lot more detail in there. But I'll go back to how I got the job a little bit. So in 1997, I think was the year Grand Forks flooded and the Red River, you know, was big, big flood year for the state. And I was still at the aviation section working flight ops. And the adjutant general at the time had said, I need some aerial photos of the Red River to see what's going on. And so the commander of the aviation facility and the pilots all sat around and literally, they looked around the room and go, who knows how to use a camera? And they looked at me and said, Kyle, you have a camera, right? I said, yeah. I didn't know how to use it. I had one for years. I didn't know how to use it. I just put it on automatic and knew that. This is back in the film days, right?
Yeah.
I knew that when, when I set that film off and got it back from Walmart or, you know, whatever drugstore, that there was images on it. They weren't great, but I knew I could take some pictures. So they said, we are going to throw you in the back of the helicopter, fly you to Fargo, you take the pictures of the Red River, get them back here, get them developed, and get them to the general right away. Okay. Again, you know, I just put my camera on automatic, but I was the best option they had at the moment.
Yeah.
Long story short, it worked. Got back, got the film developed, the pictures were there, the general was happy. I became kind of known as when somebody needs somebody with a camera, call Kyle. Again, didn't know what I was doing with a camera, but I had one. It was my personal camera. So anyway, when the job came up here for in the six shop for the visual information department, I at least could put that on my resume to say, hey, I took pictures of the Red River during the flood. And so, and I have my own camera. And I didn't lie, but I said, I know how to use a camera. Sure. I didn't. But I knew, you know, again, I came back with images, so I must know something. So that's how I got started. And again, I could talk about how that grew, mm-hmm. you know, prior to that. But that's how I got the visual information job, and I never looked back. Some of my happiest time on the full-time side, on the technician side, yeah. again, loved aviation, loved what I was doing, enjoyed my time at State Maintenance Office. But when I got into being able to do photography mm-hmm. full-time, it was a gift.
Yeah.
It was a blessing, and I never looked back. I just absolutely loved it.
Yeah. Your story is fantastic, and the reason why I say it's fantastic, because it resonates with me personally on a different level. So your story of getting into where you were and then eventually becoming that person that people called for photography, it almost, like I said, with towing the line, you end up doing more than what yeah. your duty job requires you, and you kind of have that thought process of where you're at. One thing I do want to allude to, you, right, is at the time, you said public affairs were the only trained people mm-hmm. to have and operate cameras on the full-time side, and including the MPAD at the time,
right.
which are the M-Day public affairs people.
Yep.
Visual information was the full-time technician side outside of the public affairs realm. So can you talk about the differences and the separations as you became VI, the VI photographer and the manager, and how those roles were very different but very similar at the same time?
Sure. Yeah, they are very similar. You know, when you see somebody with a camera that knows how to operate a camera, that's a skill set.
Mm-hmm.
And whether they're working for public affairs or VI, it's the same skill set.
Right.
You can hand me the public affairs camera and I can run it. I can hand public affairs a camera and they can run it. It's mm-hmm. the same skill set. So when people see somebody walk in the room with a camera, they just go, oh, public affairs is here.
Right.
And I fought so hard for 10, 15 years to try to get it into people's brains that they are separate things.
Yeah.
Now, how they're separate is their behind-the-scenes mission.
Right.
Public affairs is to go out and be public. You know, they gather stories, they gather photos, they gather footage, video footage for public use.
Right.
To give that to, you know, the public eye.
Mm-hmm.
Visual information on the other side, and they still use it this way today, visual information is for a unit commander.
Mm.
The camera operator goes out and gets photo and video footage. Particularly, they talk about VI in times of war.
Yeah.
They embed a VI person, a photographer, with a unit who's out actually on the ground doing, you know, following the soldiers that are actually in the firefight. They bring that back to the commander and say, here's what's actually going out in the field, sir or ma'am.
Right.
And then the commander can make decisions based on that visual information.
Ah.
It was never intended to be for the public, right? Back in the days, and I'm thinking of Vietnam and Korea in particular, reporters would come
yeah.
and be embedded with mm-hmm. the frontline soldiers. And even though theirs went to the public, the commands still use that information
mm-hmm.
to say, oh, there's that hilltop over there. We've got enemy up there because we have a photo of it. We can prove it.
Mm-hmm.
We need to attack that hill, whatever that case is. So there, the back office mission, if you will, of public affairs and VI is different. One is strictly to give to the news media and
right.
and mom and dad and husbands and wives at home, the public. And the other is, this is strictly for the commander's eyes, not for the public's eyes.
Yeah.
So he can make command decisions during war. Now, bring that back to a peacetime scenario. We still do that. Part of visual information was to take pictures that maybe the National Guard's building a new armory.
Right.
Well, we want to go capture that for historical purposes. Maybe, you know, we did the DA photos. That's mm-hmm. part of our mission, not a public affairs mission, because that's a soldier's career. That's behind the scenes. That's not for the public's viewing. So all those things, and I tried so very hard to keep those separate, and did a fairly good job around Bismarck and around Frame Barracks mm-hmm. that they're two separate things. But when you went to Camp Grafton or to Fargo or during AT or whatever, and again, you walk in the room with a camera, to this day, they still go, hey
public affairs. Yeah. And I'm like, ha, you yeah. thought. You can't say anything, though.
So that's one of those things in my career that I had to, you know, grow and let go of and mm-hmm. say, okay, I don't care if they call me public affairs. It doesn't matter. You know,
right.
I'm there to do my job. I'm there to get that video footage or those photos or whatever the case is. I don't care what they call me.
Right.
I'm still there to do a job, and yep. I'm just going to do the job.
Yeah, we talk about the duties and the roles, very much very public use, very story-based, like getting information of the awesome things that the military is doing out to the public for people to see. And even to this day, like we just had fires in the, funny story, we were, countering the fires in Bear Den and all over western side of North Dakota. And I got a call and was like, hey, can you come get photos of this? We need videos or we need photo. And this is after the massive fire that happened that Saturday when the wind took it and just demolished everything in its path. And so this was the day after we got the call. We came in and, it was like, hey, we need to make product for this. We need to get it out because no one could cover it the day of because, well, it was too dangerous, And we got out there and while we're getting soldiers processed in and stuff like that, I'm doing the thing, visual information, taking photos for the historical reference that this happened on this day. And I don't know, I was in the back room with the camera and they looked at me, hey, public affairs, can you come up and talk public affairs? And I'm like, oh yeah, sure. Sure.
Yeah. Kind of the irony of that too, that I learned very quickly in VI is even though I was fighting to keep the two offices and the two missions separate is you can be, Sam, the best photographer in the military.
Yeah.
And take the greatest picture, the government's ever seen. Mm-hmm. And without public affairs, nobody's ever going to see that picture.
Yeah.
So I learned very quickly that, okay, I'm visual information. I have a different mission. But without giving that image to public affairs to put out to the public,
right,
nobody's ever going to see, and understand what's going on either. So there's a separateness of, okay, it's confidential or, not necessarily secret, but it's what the public doesn't need to know is going on, especially during war, versus here's an amazing photo that I took during combat. I didn't, but I'm seeing.
Yeah, no, but in this situation, yeah.
But without public affairs, that photo would never be seen. Now, social media is part of the reason, I think, that we've had to merge public affairs and visual information because you can be VI out in the field during that fire taking that photo. It's for the generals to make decisions on and the pilots maybe to say,
we got to
get this area over here, whatever it is. But you now can get that out to the public from where you're at immediately. Mm-hmm. It's instantaneous. So that has helped blur that line some more of, what's the difference between VI and public affairs. And as much as I fought it and I tried so hard for years, I've now given in to there is no difference.
Very, very similar.
Yeah, it without one, the other wouldn't probably exist.
Yeah. No, and it's interesting you say that, Public affairs has to deal with not just the public, but also like, okay, well, we're sending people out. Who's the point of contact on the site? Well, we're not going to take that colonel and say, sir, we need you to talk about this. No, we're going to have a public affairs person that's within that area that's receiving the same updates and then publicly releasing that.
Sure.
So that way he can still do his job,
Right.
So that adverse, with the merger, we've started to realize, well, yeah, hey, Sam, go. And then your direct community line of communication is the public affairs person to really, work with the command teams and then use all that information that they receive while on the job.
My first foray into that was after Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah.
I went down strictly, in my mind, strictly as a photographer to capture, what the military was doing in support of after Hurricane Katrina, the disaster in Louisiana. And I did that, and I took thousands of pictures while I was there, and it was wonderful. But I was working for the public affairs officer, and one day he grabbed me and said, hey, I need you to go on this helicopter, with this two-star general, and,
get the photos,
get the photos, but you need to be his media escort.
Yeah.
And I went, I don't do media escort. And he looked at me and said, you do now. Get on that helicopter and go, right? So that was my first foray into, having to deal with media and stuff. And I realized, hey, I can do this. And, I wasn't a public affairs person, but I knew enough about and working with them enough about, what to say, what not to say. So it was kind of my first foray was during that disaster that I had to, again, I had to morph myself a little bit and be able to do both. And it worked out just fine.
What's been the most what's your favorite photo you've taken, or what's the best event that you had to take photos for? Like, what was your most memorable?
Sure. Boy, so many things rushing back, and then I know I'm going to forget something that, I was unprepared to answer this, but
sorry.
I, I will say this, that, again, saying yes to things mm-hmm. in a career can be very helpful. There's not many things that have come by in my military career that I've been asked to do that I've said no to.
Mm-hmm.
I always believe that saying yes to things leads to something, generally speaking, and generally something good. Not all the time, but generally. My most memorable things with the camera is I got to spend a week in Bosnia with a deployed unit over there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I took a couple great photos that had nothing to do with the soldiers and soldiers that were deployed over there. You know, we went downtown Sarajevo one day, and I have a picture on my wall to this day, one of the greatest pictures I think I've ever taken. But going to Bosnia for a week, and then I've been able to take four trips to Africa
mm-hmm.
with my camera, following the various tags around. Generally, General Sprintzenatic and General Dorman both took me along. So I've been to Africa four times with a camera.
Mm-hmm.
Who gets that opportunity?
Not many.
Nobody.
Not
right?
many.
So, but just by saying yes, you know, so one day it was said, hey, we should send you over to take some pictures of what the guys are training on in Ghana. You know, mm-hmm. are you interested? Yes.
Yes.
You know, and that led to four trips overseas. And, you know, I never would have made those trips without a camera in my hand. Mm-hmm. I never would have been to Bosnia without a camera in my hand. And it was never deployed. They were, you know, week-long trips, all of them. But got to see parts of the world. You know, we stopped in Germany. We stopped in Amsterdam. We did all these things. And all I had to do was take pictures of it, mm-hmm. you know, record what was going on. Nobody gets that opportunity. I think over Nyírgárd, you know, their famous photographer, Dave Lipp, who was there for years, mm-hmm. magnificent photographer, puts me to shame. You know, he got to ride in an F4 or maybe an F16 at the time.
Nice.
Just doing photos. Who gets to do that, right?
Yeah.
Joe Public walking down the street doesn't get to do that.
No, no.
So I always really enjoyed whenever, and oh my gosh, so many. I've visited nearly every state in the union. I have gone to, I don't know how many conferences, I don't know how many events
mm-hmm.
that took me there because of my camera. And I've just got, I've been able to experience so much of the world
mm-hmm.
looking through the viewfinder.
Yeah.
And oh my gosh, that is just things that I have never taken for granted, will never mm-hmm. take lightly, and will never forget.
Yeah.
Those opportunities that I had just because one day a pilot said, who do we know that has a camera? And I happened to be in the room.
Yeah.
It all led up to that. And you know, I left visual information and went to cybersecurity. It was a choice, not that I wanted to make, but I felt I had to make a career decision. Worked out for me, but my heart has always been, you know, anytime I have that opportunity to put a camera in my hands to support this organization, I'm doing it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm all in. I'm there because I just absolutely love photography. And in I think very few people in the world get to take a passion that they absolutely love and turn that into a paid position.
Mm-hmm.
My wife talks about this. We've talked about this many times over our 37 years of marriage, that somehow, maybe, I manifested that.
Mm.
Because I'll tell you how I got my first camera. I remember being probably in middle school, 7th or 8th grade, and for Christmas, I got this coffee table book of all the weird things to give a middle school kid, a coffee table picture book, right? And it was, my parents knew that I was a hippie kid back in the 60s and 70s. I loved rock and roll music of any kind. My whole family was into country music, and I wasn't. I was the outlier. I liked rock and roll. They got me this book, and again, just a picture book, pictures from the Rolling Stone magazine, and it was just a thick, large, like 11 by 17 photo book of rock and roll music.
Mm-hmm.
Just a documentary book. I spent, Sam, I don't know how many hours of my youth with that book. And there's a picture in that book that, in the best possible way, haunts me to this day. And it's a picture of three musicians known as Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
Yeah, okay.
progressive 70s rock band.
Yep.
And there was something about that photo. The look on those three guys' faces and the way the photographer took the photo. And, of course, I knew nothing about photography mm-hmm. other than looking at pictures. But there's something to that. To this day, that picture is etched in my brain so deeply. And years later, in fact, just a couple years ago, I went online and I found that picture. I've since lost that book. I wish I had that book back. I looked very recently. I can't find that picture online anymore. I'm sure it's still there. Anyway, I say all this to say that's where I got my love for photography, but I did not know it at the time. Mm-hmm. Another thing that I knew about myself my whole life is I am, and this is going to sound weird and bad when I say it, but I use the word voyeur, but I'm a people watcher.
Okay.
I'm an observer. Yeah. By nature, I'm an observer. We just got back from my 42nd trip to Disney World, and most of the trip, my wife and I sat on a park bench in the Disney parks watching people.
Yeah.
We just absolutely, my wife is the same way, we are observers. So I've known that my whole life. And being able to put that camera in front of my face, look through that viewfinder, and observe the world, and observe life, and observe nature, and observe people, that is my inner, that's who I am. That's yeah. just who I am at my core. I graduated high school in 1983. We were very, very poor. Mm-hmm. Didn't have any money, you know, didn't expect anything. We were homeless twice when I was a kid. That's how poor we were. Not, we didn't have a roof over our head, but we didn't have a home to sleep in for two times in my life. And when I graduated high school, it was probably 2 weeks after high school. Mm-hmm. And we were near Minot, and we were in Minot, and my mom said, hey, I'm going to go to Kmart to pick up a few things. Do you want to go? Okay, I was bored, didn't have nothing to do, so I went to Kmart with my mom on a Saturday. And she's shopping around the store, and she happened to find me at the camera counter. And I was just looking at the camera counter because I knew I liked photography, but I didn't know why. And she came up behind me, and she said, what are you doing? Eh, just looking, you know, knowing there was no money to buy mm-hmm. anything. I never got a senior gift, if you will. There just was no such thing in our family. Anyway, out of the blue, my mom said, do you want a camera? And I'm like, well, yeah, but yeah. I don't have the money for that. And she said, you know, we never got you anything for graduation. If you would like a camera, I will buy you a camera. Well, it just so happened she had been laid off, if you will, from a job, and she had gotten a small severance check. So she had a few dollars, and I went, Mom, I don't want to use your money. She said, no, I can afford this. If you want a camera, I'll buy you a camera. And I walked out of Kmart in Minot that day with a camera and a lens in my hand.
I love that.
Again, had no clue. Again, like you said, what's an f-stop? Mm-hmm. What's a shutter speed? What's an ISO? I never heard those terms. Didn't know. So anyway, that's how I got my very first camera. I still have that camera sitting on a shelf at home. And I love that camera. It took great pictures. But I, for years, like I said earlier, just put it on automatic and hope when the film comes back. Obviously a film camera. I hoped when film came back there was images on it. Sometimes there was, sometimes there wasn't. the ones that were there probably were not very good in retrospect compared to what I do now. But again, that started that journey of where I am today. Now I run a side business.
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely love taking people portrait pictures. Mm-hmm. I like nature pictures. I do a little bit of everything. But if you were to ask me who I am inside and what I am, I am a photographer.
Ugh. That is just, first off, like I'm holding back tears here. That was just, that was beautiful. You're on your way to retiring. And to have that, not like knowing, like I'm a photographer,
yeah.
For you to have that that just, it's exciting. 'Cause now it's like, now I can take what I know and what I love and I could focus on that, and I can do that, yeah. you know, and however much you want. So
you're so speaking my language. You know, I first of all, it took me up until, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago to call myself a photographer. Because, again, imposter syndrome was there.
Yeah.
You know, sure, I knew a little bit of studio lighting, or I maybe know studio lighting now. I know my camera inside out. Mm-hmm. I know every setting on that camera. I know what it's going to do. I know how to use a camera. Mm-hmm. But it took me many, many years, you know, 55 years, and 30 of that with a camera in my hand, or 35 of that, for me to finally not be embarrassed and not be afraid to tell somebody, I'm a photographer.
Yeah,
I can go to a photo conference now full of 5,000 photographers and stand there and say, I am a photographer.
I know what I'm doing.
I know what the hell I'm doing. Right? So there's that. And then, like you said, my impending retirement, I have, you know, just a couple days left until I leave the federal government. And yes, I do have some of that. Hey, I've spent 40 years and 4 months and 18 days with the North Dakota National Guard. I've been told what to do, how to do it, with a manual, that entire time. And now I'm going to walk away from that. Do I know who I am and what I want to be when I grow up? Mm-hmm. That answer is no, with the caveat that I know photography. And if there's nothing else in my life that makes any sense, I can grab that camera out of my bag, put that up to my eye, and the world makes sense to me.
This has been amazing. Again, I can't thank you enough, and we all congratulate you on your upcoming retirement this month, and we will definitely have a little shindig to celebrate it. If you have any last things to say, I
appreciate your words. You know, I don't know if everybody, you know, who does a career anywhere, hopes they walk out leaving a little bit of a legacy. My legacy, I hope, is two things, and that is, first of all, I truly feel like I've built a great team. I've told the Adjutant General, when I leave at the end of this month and retire, this organization will not even feel a speed bump, because I have set it up and trained and resourced the people behind me, in my opinion, so well that they are just doing the job without me. I'm just standing by watching now, which I think is what a good leader probably should be doing. You know, if leading is one thing, training the others to do their job and to lead themselves is another thing. And I think that's maybe something I've done right. The photos I've taken over the last 24 years, 22 years, some of those are going to stay here and be on people's walls, you know. I took a lot of DA photos over the years of a lot of soldiers, and they got promoted because of that photo, because they had that photo on file. So did I positively affect a lot of people's lives? I like to think so. Maybe in a very small way, and maybe in an unknown way, right? But I like to think that I affected some people's lives. And again, that legacy of all the photos that are on the server now, they're there for the organization. There's a lot of history there. Whether it gets used someday or not, someday some historian's going to look at that and go, oh, wow, that's amazing. I need that. I need that. I need that. And they can put a story together. So that seems very braggadocious to say I'm leaving a legacy, but I do feel like I've done my job, and I'm holding my head high as I retire, walking out of the organization, very proud of what I've done and the people that I've worked with. So the only other thing I'll say is two things. If anybody's listening to this and doesn't know about the opportunities of working full-time for the National Guard as an AGR or a technician or a state employee or a contract employee even, there are so many opportunities to work full-time for this organization that if you don't know about those, you're missing out. So ask somebody. Ask one of the full-timers in the unit, ask somebody that you know, just talk to people about, hey, what does it mean to work full-time for the National Guard? It is an amazing opportunity. It's taken me, again, 40 years, 4 months, and 18 days. So ask those questions. And if there's a leadership lesson at all that I could leave, I've lived my life and my leadership basically. I come back to three essays that I've read. One, just a paragraph from Theodore Roosevelt, and that's the Man in the Arena. And most people are familiar with that. You know, it's not the critic that counts. Mm-hmm. You can Google that and read that one paragraph. That always meant a lot to me. And by that, it just means that, you know, if you don't want to be criticized and you don't want to be questioned and you don't want to be anything, then don't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
But if you make the decision to step forward and be a leader and move up that chain of command or that rank structure, whatever rank you are, you're going to be criticized and talked about and whatever. But you did it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you made the decision to move forward. I'm going to take that next rank, that next responsibility. I'm going to do the best I can. Yes, are there going to be missteps and mistakes? Sure. But you did it.
Mm-hmm.
And I encourage people to do that. The other one, and this is more to me the full-time thing, is there's an essay out there written in 1899, 125 years ago, by an American author, and it's called A Message to Garcia. And a lot of military people are familiar with this a little bit, but and it's not a true story. There is some truth in it, but it's a made-up story, where during the Spanish-American War in Cuba, President McKinley needed to get a message to one of the insurgent leaders. His name was Garcia, in Cuba. But there was no telegraph lines back then. Mm-hmm. You know, how am I going to get a message to him? And somebody said, give that message to Major Rowan. He will get it to Garcia. So they called Major Rowan in the room, as the story goes. President McKinley handed him the message, piece of paper, and said, get this to Garcia in Cuba. And Major Rowan turned around, left the room, and 3 weeks later, 3+ weeks later, delivered the message in Cuba. The message of the whole, or the crux of the story, is he didn't ask, who's Garcia? He didn't ask, how do I get there? How am I going to eat? Who's going to take me? He didn't ask any questions. He just took the damn letter, turned around, and 3.5 or 4 weeks later, delivered it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of person you should try to be. Is I'm not going to whine that, why do I have to do it? Or mm-hmm. why isn't so-and-so do it? Or why don't you do it yourself? When you're given a task by someone in charge, just do the damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes a leader. Okay. And the third one that I've for a long time I've had posted in my office, and I even carried it in my wallet for a long time, is a short essay, almost a poem almost, but John Walter Wayland, I think was his name. And he wrote this, and it's called The True Gentleman. And it's just, again, one paragraph long, and it's very clearly defines what it means to be a true gentleman. And again, you can go out and Google that, find it, and read it for yourself. But the first time I read it, I just remember being taken aback, going, wow.
Mm-hmm.
If I just follow those rules in life,
mm-hmm.
I'll be a man of value, which is something I've always tried to be. And so I would encourage people to find, it doesn't have to be those three for sure, find something that's meaningful to you, that is a thing that you will live by, live your life by, and follow it. You know, be flexible. You know, a little bit in life, you got to be some pliability there in life. We all know that. But find something that's meaningful to you and live by it.
I love it. I love it. I cannot thank you again so much for, first off, coming on here and letting us record everything that you've done for me personally as a human being and as well as one of your employees. Thank you so much. Thank you for your incredible service that you've given to this organization. And definitely we'll hit you up for some photography outside of this.
I would love that.
So, well, for anyone listening online, thanks for listening in. This has been a little bit longer of a podcast, but, it's been one of the best conversations I've had. I hope you enjoyed it just as much as I did. But with that, we'll talk to you next time.